all the way to 51. Right now, wind northwest at 13, 37 degrees in Kenosha, 35 this morning in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Something is about to begin today, later today, in Washington, D.C. An extraordinary gathering of leaders from democracies around the world. The second annual Summit for Democracy. And the first such democracy held in Summit for Democracy held in 2021 ended up being the catalyst for a really extraordinary book called How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration from 95 World Leaders, a book which thoughtfully gathers and curates and presents to the reader a beautiful articulation of the importance of democracy, of the way in which it changes lives for the better, and the various threats which democracy is facing both here and in democracies all around the world. The book is the work of one, Dr. Eli Merritt, who is a political historian at Vanderbilt University, someone who has written for the New York Times, the LA Times, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the American Journal of Legal History, among many, many others, and with at least a couple of other books to his credit, and this most recent, published by Amplify, again titled How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration from 95 World Leaders. Professor Eli Merritt, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be with you, Greg.
I just called you Professor Eli Merritt, and I want to get some clarification because your biography lists you as a political historian at Vanderbilt University. Could we take just a moment to find out exactly what that means, what it means to be a political historian at a place like Vanderbilt, and do your responsibilities there also include teaching history?
That's a great question, Greg. I'm actually on my second career. I practiced psychiatry for 20 years with some teaching in ethics and other subjects at Stanford. And then in 2018, I was invited to come to Vanderbilt as a visiting scholar to, I think the best way to think about it is to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I was at a crossroads between staying in psychiatry and writing about depression, which is my expertise in psychiatry, and pivoting back to my original academic interest as an undergrad, which was history. And in the end, I think in part due to the troubles in our democracy at that time, I decided to pivot into the writing of history and into writing political commentary. So I would say my description of myself as a political historian has to do with two things. The opinion essays that I have written since 2018 focus on what we might think of as applied history, a history mainly of the founding period, but also some of the Civil War period applied to our contemporary politics. And the other is I do have a history book coming out this June called Disunion Among Ourselves, The Perilous Politics of the American Revolution. So that's my area of specialty within political history. My affiliation is in the Department of Political Science at Vanderbilt. So political history, of course, is the things I've said, but it's also trying to look back at the complexities of history, but specifically through the prism of governmental and political affairs.
Very good. And do you actually work with students at Vanderbilt, or is your role there one that essentially involves little, if any, interaction with and working with students?
It has involved some supervision of students. I'm a research professor, so most of what I do is research. I also have been working remotely for the past number of years. I live in San Francisco most of the time. I'm in Nashville now, but I do some teaching, and I'm actually planning not this semester, but upcoming semester, hopefully to teach a course that has a working title right now, How Democracies Thrive. So I will be doing more teaching in the future. Mainly I've been working on completing my history book, Disunion Among Ourselves, and recently, as you have said, this collection of essays from the first summit called How Democracies Die.
It is a really remarkable book, and I'm so glad we have the opportunity today to talk about it. You tell us, sadly, that early in the book that this project actually began during what you call a period of grief in my life. Explain what was going on in your personal life, and maybe just say a word about why you wanted to be sure to say that at the outset. I mean, in a sense, why did you think it was important for we as readers to know this about the genesis of the project?
Well, I think that's a good question, and as I think about it right now, I think probably the reason I included that true story of the fact that the summit occurred during the period of my father's decline and last chapter of life is that I think that so many Americans now are dealing with what's best described as grief, a deep-seated grief over what is taking place in our democracy. Another way to think about it is people who have been watching our democracy struggle along, certainly over the past 50 years, but struggle along in a progressive way now, I think, more than ever before in our contemporary history, really feel a sense of grief and worry. So I thought to myself as I was experiencing this that the summit actually helped me. I actually watched the speeches of the summit during off times. My brother and my sister and I were at the bedside of my father, and when I was off shift, so to speak, I would go back to where I was staying and listen to the speeches. And another remarkable thing is my father was a federal judge and an extraordinary defender of democracy. So there was a beautiful sort of poetry to my doing that same work in these shifts between times at his bedside. But the Summit for Democracy certainly gave me hope about democracy. There was tremendous positive energy at the summit about fighting hard and working hard to restore democracy. There were beautiful expressions, which may seem unnecessary decades ago, but beautiful expressions about the fact that there is no other form of government that has been invented or discovered by human beings in the past several millennia that comes anywhere close to being as wonderful as democracy in terms of its support of personal freedoms and opportunities. And now I'm thinking of a few quotations from the book that are from the first summit. So there was an emphasis on democracy is the only place you can go if you're pursuing self-actualization. And that was the words of one of the leaders. Another said, it's the only place you can go if you're looking for self-realization. And others emphasized the only place that you can go to pursue human dignity and human fulfillment. So I appreciate that question. I really do feel like, and additionally, I was, like others, dealing with some grief over the state of our democracy at that time. It also coincided with the first anniversary of the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. So I do believe anyone out there that's feeling grief or disillusion or some feelings of hopelessness about our democracy, this book is a great place to go both to learn about democracy and to find a sense of hope and inspiration. And there are certainly other books I can think of that it, for me over the years have served a similar purpose. And I think of a great book of speeches and letters by Abraham Lincoln. And the way to identify that book is it has an introduction written by Gore Vidal and another just remarkably inspiring collection of letters and speeches is those of Martin Luther King, and that book is called A Testament of Hope. So I put this book alongside those as serving the dual purpose of teaching us about democracy and also giving us a strong sense of hope.
You tell us the book also stemmed, at least in part, from what amounts to a challenge issued by President Joe Biden. Tell us about that challenge and the way in which this book was your effort to respond to that challenge.
Well, this summit and the next summit, or particularly the first summit, was organized with a primary focus on unifying democracies against the growing threat of authoritarianism and corruption, and for the purpose of advancing human rights. And so as part of that, you know, more than once, Biden made clear, we're going to make the coming year a year of action, and we will be gathering again in another year, which is what is coming up, a little bit more than a year after the first one, the second summit for democracy, as you mentioned, which is starting today. At that time, Biden was not necessarily issuing this injunction of a year of action, I think, to your average citizens out there like myself. But I think if he had not issued that need, let's make this a year of action, I don't think probably I would have put this book together. So I did. Part of my motivation was what we had talked about already, but also it was a sense that Biden said it's a year of action. And I do believe that that is the way, to borrow from the title of the book, that is the way that we save democracy, is citizens getting involved. Of, by, and for the people includes the necessity at times of crisis or at times of trouble, particularly when the political leadership might be somewhat compromised, that it is really up to the people to get involved. And we could talk more about that. I know that's very challenging for most people, but I, through whatever pathways, had already committed myself to being an advocate and doing my small part for our democracy. So this beautiful command to a year of action had an impact on me. And what I did during the year of action was I put together this book.
We're speaking with Eli Merritt, political historian at Vanderbilt University, and the author, or maybe editor, curator is maybe even a better term, for the new book, How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration from 95 World Leaders. It gathers together more than 400 quotations and excerpts from remarks made by a wide array of world leaders at the 2021 Summit for Democracy. Maybe you could describe to our listeners a little more about what this event itself was. And I have a feeling that that a casual observer might regard it as a big, long meeting with a whole lot of speeches. And I strongly suspect that, first of all, it was indeed more than that, and that, in fact, this was an important gathering that we really need to appreciate and understand. Tell us more about what exactly occurred at this 2021 Summit for Democracy.
I mean, you're right to say that there were many components of the summit. One of the signature components was that each of the participants, more than 100 world leaders and some leaders of world organizations, submitted, and this was virtual. The 2021 summit was virtual, and the upcoming one is partially virtual and partially in person. But they submitted what was called participant statements or speeches that were 5 to 10 minutes each, in which they described what they were doing for democracy, and as part of that, they provided interpretations and inspirations surrounding democracy. That's the place from which I derived the quotations. But in addition to that, the world leaders got to know one another better. They had individual meetings and gatherings on specific topics such as technology and the rule of law and other subjects. But we've made some allusion to, and I think one of the things that perhaps we don't appreciate enough about gatherings like this, and in particular during difficult times for democracy such as we're experiencing today, in fact, in the United States and globally with a 15-year advance of authoritarianism, is the need the first need, I think, for all of us is to study democracy and understand democracy better. I feel like over the past number of decades, we have developed a quite oversimplified view of what democracy is. And so one from the 2021 summit, one of the world leaders, the president of Lithuania, said, and it's really one of my favorite, most meaningful quotations from this summit. He said, you know, we are gathered here at this summit to deepen our understanding of how democracy works and how tyranny happens. And so the world leaders came up with numerous practical plans. They allocated money towards many different specific purposes and initiatives. But I think the most underappreciated value of the summit, and something that I'm trying to expand on, and I feel we should all expand on, is just that core principle that we need to understand how democracy works. I thought 5 years ago when I began to study democracy in depth, I thought I knew how democracy works, but as deep learning always teaches us, it teaches us what we don't know instead of what we know. And just as an example of this, I do believe that we're at a place in our history, in the United States, but also in other democracies, where we simplify democracy down to, well, what is democracy? Democracy is a system of government that works on free and fair elections. And importantly, we need to expand that out. Free and fair elections is a vital cornerstone, you could say the most vital cornerstone, but I could also make the argument that there are co-equal other cornerstones equally as important to free and fair elections, and they are the rule of law, checks and balances, and the most neglected or poorly understood cornerstone of democracy is ethical leadership. And so without those four cornerstones, if any of them weaken or the cornerstone crumbles, the house of democracy can collapse ultimately. So that really, to me, when I think of this summit and I think of what all Americans need to do in the coming decade, say, it's really study democracy, understand democracy, and then we move towards reforming democracy.
One of the things that was, of course, a hallmark of the first summit and of the second summit that, again, begins later today, is that it's not just a meeting of kind of the looming democracies that sort of tower over everybody else, the democracies that we immediately think of, but this is actually democracies from all around the world coming in all shapes and sizes. And I think I did not really stop to think about that until really examining your book, the fact that I think a lot of us, when we think about democracy, only think about it, in a sense, in the grandest scale. When we think about the great democracies of the world, such as the United States, I mean, great at least in terms of just sheer size and dominance and influence, and of course, great in some other ways too, but great not to imply perfect or in need of some redemption. But back to the main point, which is that this summit is not just about kind of those world powers, but about all kinds of other democracies on a far different scale. What would you say is the significance of that, about that kind of inclusive spirit of the previous summit and this present one? And what kind of difference do you think it has made in terms of the discussions that occurred and the good that was accomplished?
Well, I think you're underscoring another fundamentally important part of the summit that occurred and also the coming summit, and that really is the bringing together of diverse democracies of vastly different sizes and vastly different economies. And that's important in some ways because that's where we're going in the world. And to me, there's a symbolic importance as well. I do believe that the United States has spent the period, certainly since World War II, instructing the world on how democracy should operate. And for some good reason, we have been a successful democracy and a beacon of democracy. But now our democracy it's not just a little compromised, it's extraordinarily compromised. So this is a time, and no better president to do it than Biden, who I think is very humble. This is a time for us to begin to look towards other democracies for both collaboration and points of learning about how to strengthen democracy and make democracy endure these difficult times of disinformation and other technological challenges. But another remarkable thing that stood out to me from the summit is the way I think of it is the island, the small island democracies. I'm thinking of Bermuda and Barbados. I found myself truly fascinated to hear so many of those world leaders really talking about what I think of as the soft side of democracy. There's a hard side. The enforcement of the rule of law, for example, is an aspect of the hard side of democracy. But this soft side, another quote that I am very fond of came from the Prime Minister of Barbados. Her name, wonderfully, is Mia Amor Motley. And she said that really the secret sauce, the thing that makes their democracy work, is that we see one another, we listen to one another, and we care for one another. And I know that sounds like a lot of soft stuff, but we must recall that those qualities of democracy are equally as essential as the hard side of democracy. And just to put it in its proper place, Mia Amor Motley really reminded me greatly of Abraham Lincoln, who in all of his speeches, but I think now of the second inaugural, where he counseled us all to live political lives grounded in malice for none and charity for all. So you didn't hear a lot of discussion of love, compassion, and care coming from the traditional Western European democracies of the United States. But we certainly heard that from these smaller island democracies, and I think we have a lot to learn from that, among many other things.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you highlighted that, and if you don't mind, I want to read in its entirety that excerpt that you just highlighted from, again, the Prime Minister of Barbados, where she said, "We must never forget that democracy is not simply a monolithic institutional construct. It is about people. And this is why we must commit always to seeing each other, to hearing each other, and to caring for each other. If we can do this, then we can give breath to democracy each and every day." I really appreciate that. And I think one of the reasons I think it has is such an important sentiment for us as Americans to try and embrace and maybe put into action in deeper ways is because I think that is, for all of the connectedness that technology allows us to have, we are connecting, it seems to me, more and more poorly with those with whom we differ. And I think, for instance, of the people who, in a sense, led the charge of that assault on the nation's capital on January 6th, that one of the most challenging aspects of what that prime minister just said is that it is not just that we understand and appreciate those with whom we have kind of an easy rapport, but that somehow we have to come to hear each other and see each other, including those people who found themselves driven to such a terrible, despicable act. I mean, nevertheless, at least for some of them, that sprang from some kind of terrible hunger or pain or fear or something. And I think those of us who watch that with horror have not gone beyond our sense of horror to try to understand, at least in the hearts of some of those people, what drove them to do that. And it seems to me that what the Prime Minister of Barbados is telling us is that a real democracy means seeing everybody within that democracy, including people that maybe have a very, very different view of their own lives and our collective lives together. I don't know that I'm making much sense there, but that's one of the things that these powerful words from the Prime Minister of Barbados make me think about.
Oh, I think you're saying perhaps the most remarkable and important thing that can be said at this juncture in our history. And as you were saying it, I was just imagining what you were saying, going out, maybe not quite 24/7, but let's say many hours per day on outlets like CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. I think that is what you just expressed in reading the quote by Mia Moore Motley is really what the nation needs. And I've had to think quite a bit lately about the question, you know, what is it that every citizen who cares and loves our democracy, what can they do? I'm asked that, so I had to sort of figure out what I think. And the first thing is to, what we've discussed so far, study democracy, understand democracy, and if you can, find a way to get involved with democracy or strengthening our democracy. But the other thing that everyone can do that is much more emotional and can be done on your private time and self-contemplation is the vast importance to, again, underscore what you've said, is to do not hate your fellow Americans. We can deplore the policies of others and behaviors and acts like January 6th, but it is important, as you have said, to have sympathy for those who are suffering and the type of suffering and pain that leads to violence. And what's vitally important, too, is to recognize that, in the example you gave, all of those individuals who were physically involved with attacking the Capitol, they had been deceived and deluded by political leaders led by Donald Trump, but not only him. So in some ways, they are victims of deceit and delusion by their political leaders. So we should be upset and angry at our political leaders, not at our fellow Americans, as you're saying. And we should get back to the underlying premises of Mia Amor Motley and Abraham Lincoln, malice towards none and compassion towards all. It doesn't mean we don't push hard for what we believe in. It doesn't mean we don't fight for ethical constitutional democracy and fight against disinformation and corruption and authoritarianism. But through soul searching, those things can be done even more effectively if we are understanding and not experiencing hate towards our fellow Americans.
In a sense, I think one of the things that we need to guard against, and I think over and over we are reminded about this in various ways in your book, How to Save Democracy, is to not give in to the temptation of demonization. And of course, demonization happens in both directions, and it probably sometimes happens because it's just easier to lump people with whom we feel great discomfort and in a sense marginalize them as kind of all but evil demonic influences and so on. And in a sense, it's important for us to be really careful about doing that, and when we can, to try to come to some kind of understanding about why somebody holds a position, even if that's a position that feels diametrically opposite of our own. And there are various people who talk about how that is one of the lifebloods of democracy, and one of them, our current president. You quote President Joe Biden at one point as saying, "Democracy is hard. We all know that. It works best with consensus and cooperation." And I think he's pointing to something that we often don't stop to realize can be very challenging.
Yes, and I think the burden is on the citizens of the United States. In spite of the current state of our political culture, the burden is on citizens to, in some ways, divorce or separate themselves from much of the culture in order to find that place of understanding and compassion and understanding for others. We live in a culture, obviously, I think, most responsible in the painful place of polarization and hatred that both sides are experiencing is the media. And we've lost in the media really anchoring in codes of ethics. So the people, unfortunately, are turning to institutions like Fox News, in some ways thinking we're seeking news, and there are tidbits of news in there, but really it's not a true news organization. So it just, my point in bringing that up is the challenges of citizens to maintain a sense of compassion and understanding towards one another are extremely difficult due to both social media, which needs in the coming decades to find its way to codes of ethics, and most vitally because the news media is truly, I believe, a fourth branch of government or the fourth estate of government. We have to clean house in our media in order to restore the strength of our democracy. It's essential. It's when I brought up the four cornerstones of democracy, one of them was ethical leadership, and that certainly applies, fundamentally applies to the news media.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eli Merritt, political historian at Vanderbilt University and author, editor, curator of a new book called How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration from 95 World Leaders. Those 95 world leaders gathered together for the 2021 Summit for Democracy, and a new Summit for Democracy is underway beginning today. Mr. Merritt, do you have time for a couple more questions?
Sure.
By the way, as we were just talking about the importance of greater understanding, I'm reminded of one of my favorite lines from the president of Argentina, Alberto Fernandez, when he said, "Above all, democracy is dialogue." And boy, that succinctly says something that is can be wonderful, can feel wonderful. And sometimes dialogue can be very, very painful when we're engaged in dialogue with people who seem to be seeing the world upside down from the way that we see it. But there's great truth in those few simple words, aren't there?
Yes, and if I can't recall exactly right now where one would find these other quotations in the book, but there are at least two, if not three, where there is allusion made to dialogue, but more helpfully, perhaps, they say that the essence of democracy is respectful dialogue. So that is the key thing there, is not just dialogue, but respectful dialogue. And I've lately been giving great thought to the different types of democratic values that are essential to the health and functioning of democracy. And we most frequently think of political values, critically. These are, we can't have successful democracy without them. Political values like equality and the rule of law, constitutionalism, justice, these are essential. But there's also what is being neglected now and what we're learning about now as being so essential to democracy is what we might consider to be democratic behavioral values. And those behavioral values, among others, are civility, respect, truth, mutual understanding, building consensus, compromise, cooperation, and then some of the other aspects we've already spoken about, caring and fellow feeling. So those are critical things we need to restore. I think that we've taken for granted over the course of most of our history that there have been a set of codes of ethics or ethical standards or behavioral standards which have been in place. So we've taken them for granted and have not really needed to be aware of them, but now we certainly are. And I think it's very important for us all to understand that democracy cannot survive with free speech of a poisonous nature. So one of the greatest dilemmas that we have before us today is free speech is the lifeblood or one of the lifebloods of democracy. But what happens when free speech becomes poisoned? So we need to find ways and reform moving forward over the coming decades to enjoy all of the fruits and strengths of free speech, but not the poisons of demagoguery. And when I say that, what I really mean is, to define it better, it is when the free speech about issues that's so important to democracy and progress gives way to bigotry and fear-mongering and hate-mongering and the us versus them mentality that that is afflicting us today. So we need to find our way back towards the constant striving for these democratic values of speech within speech rather than demagogic values of within speech.
One of the themes that comes up in the book, and in some respects it's kind of in a surprising way, is the whole matter of technology and the digital revolution. And of course, I think a lot has been said about how that revolution has made, in many cases, a huge difference for the better. That is, when you have ordinary citizens walking around with cell phones that can capture images, that there is a way in which a light can be shown and stories can be very powerfully told that help kind of lift up the importance of democracy and the darkness of other kinds of government that trample on people's rights. I mean, it can be a very powerful tool for good, but your book points to technology and the digital revolution as also one of the supreme challenges being faced by democracy. And I suppose part of what you're getting at there is when this powerful tool is misused in ways that are ultimately detrimental to the concept of democracy.
Yes, and that is a major, was a major emphasis of the first summit. And frankly, it's the aspect of the second summit that I'm the most excited to pay attention to. It is very clear to me that the European nations are far ahead of the United States in their understanding and their plans to take action around disinformation. We have a greater sense of free speech absolutism than most of the European countries, and it's something I intend to learn more about. And I do believe we'll have to adopt reforms that, again, vigorously protect freedom of speech, but perhaps expand concepts that are existing in our in constitutional law now, such as expanding protections surrounding defamation. We might find our way to expanding limitations surrounding incitement of violence and others. But it's important to recognize that we are indeed, even though we're more than a quarter century into the internet, we live right now in the wild west of digital communications. And one reason for that, of course, is because of the deep value we place on free speech. But this is an area of reform that, to repeat myself, to reinstate codes of ethics. Hopefully we will find our way in this wild west, and we'll find ways to overcome the extraordinary profitability of disinformation online. When you think of Alex Jones, when you think of Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox News, very sadly, much of this information is being put out not simply because the purveyor of that disinformation is in favor of the political issue or the political party, but as we know, massive sums of money are being made on disinformation. That's going to be a tough nut to crack, but it is essential that we find our way forward. And Charles Michel, who is the head of the European Council, the president of the European Council, he really led the way in the first summit with regard to making constant reference to the need to make our digital transformation be a net positive for democracy, not a net negative for democracy. So that's something I look forward to in the coming in the summit now, and it's also something I look forward to in the coming decades, which is reforms that will help us to accomplish that goal of net positivity of the digital transformation rather than destructiveness and further deterioration into demagogic speech.
Right. Mr. Michel's remarks about this, I think, were very powerful indeed. Our digital future is bursting with possibilities beyond our imaginations. We must not repeat the mistakes of the past. We must choose this powerful new resource wisely and sustainably. I also like how the Prime Minister of Denmark puts it, Mette Frederiksen, government must reclaim the steering wheel of digital development. We need to make technology for us, for our democracy, a tool for us and not for democracy, not for the opposite, touching on some really powerful matters there. I want to be sure to highlight a quote from somebody who's, you know, among the more maybe controversial figures quoted in your book, but I think he says something here so says it, it's important, and he says it very well. And this is Boris Johnson, former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, when he says, democracy is not just an ideal. It is the best practical way of creating the atmosphere of free inquiry that allows genius to breathe. Again, democracy creates the atmosphere of free inquiry that allows genius to breathe. He's not the only one in the book who touches on this matter of democracy being something in which an atmosphere is created that allows, in a sense, the highest level of human accomplishment. Can you just speak to that sentiment and maybe the most powerful ways in which we see that play out?
Yes, I think there are a number of quotations that are similar to that that underscore that democracy is the only form of government where you can go to find human flourishing, whether it's in the arts or music or technology. So that's, again, in some ways, the first summit, there is a sense of cheerleading for democracy, since there is some concern that many countries out there are on the fence of, they're watching. What is Russia going to do? What is China going to do? And what are these democracies going to do? There's some fear that if democracy loses ground, some of the, again, democracies on the fence might push more towards authoritarian forms of government. So there was great emphasis on the beauties and glories of democracy, and that's one of them. And the other, of course, as important, perhaps more important, is there's much emphasis at the first summit that democracy, well done, is the only form of government that guarantees human beings peace, the peaceful resolution of our conflicts and problems through the rule of law, through legislative processes that are based upon fighting the hard fight against views that you disagree with, but at the end of the day, practicing respect for those on the other side, and painful as it may be, forging a compromise of some kind. So indeed, we do discover it really needs to move from perhaps our unconscious or the parts of our brains that where we take democracy for granted. This really is the time for us to recognize the beautiful things about democracy, and that it is indeed the greatest system of government. It's taken thousands of years for democracy to evolve since the Greeks, which had shocked full of dangerous problems, where they only had about 100 years of relatively peaceful democracy, and then it became undone. We've worked at this for a long time, and we just have to keep working at it until we can get democracy right in the modern age, where we do have novel challenges that no human peoples or human societies have had to cope with in the past. And notably, that has to do with rapid digital communications and disinformation, which is the challenge or the thing that must be beaten back.
I'm reminded, as you say that, about something said by Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, who was a participant in this first summit, who said at one point, while democracy is not perfect, it is perfectible. And I suppose that that is one of the abiding themes of this book, How to Save Democracy, and in particular, the third and final section of the book, in which these various leaders from democracies all around the world speak to what we as ordinary citizens can do in that process of trying to bring to perfection those imperfect democracies in which each of us live and work.
Yes, and I think that there's times when the citizens can sit back and enjoy the fruits of the democracy they're living in, and there's other times where they need to not sit back and enjoy the fruits. They need to get involved and be the force that drives out disinformation and corruption and authoritarianism, and I think this is one of those times. One other area of dramatic emphasis in the summit, the past summit, and certainly the one taking place now, is going to be the theme of constant struggle. Do not take democracy for granted. It takes perpetual vigilance to keep out domestic enemies of democracy and foreign enemies of democracy. So we're at one of those times where I get an email every day that says, all hands on deck. And I think that's true. But anyone who half agrees with that, but is finding it hard to imagine there's something they could do that would matter, I think it's important to know that each person matters, that you do matter, and your struggle logically may be to figure out, well, what can you do, whether it's for 30 minutes a day or 30 minutes per week. And I think that the way to discover that is to just begin to study and understand democracy better and reflect upon yourself as you're doing that, what your skills are, what your abilities are, what your beliefs are. And then if the magic happens, find your way to get involved. There's tons of great organizations right now that are, there's an explosion of nonprofits, there's an explosion of citizens groups. And one other thing it's, I think, helpful to communicate is if you're a Republican, you could serve a vital purpose in trying to clean house in the Republican Party. The party is suffering dramatically, and it's dragging the nation down. So if you could push for ethical constitutional democracy within the Republican Party, but also we are very fortunate at this time, though no party is perfect, the Democratic Party is not perfect, that currently it is the party that is standing for the rule of law at the highest levels where it's most important. And it is the party in our nation now that is carrying the banner of the Declaration of Independence. It is carrying the banner today of all men and women and any other gender are created equal and are entitled to inalienable rights. So I think we need to strengthen the Democratic Party. We need to strengthen the Republican Party. My greatest concern over the next 20 years is that the Democratic Party might find that it is capitulating to the means of the Republican Party in the battles for power in our politics. And that would be the true crisis. If we had two parties that were suffering deeply from corruption and anti-democratic forces. So we need to strengthen both parties. But most importantly, we need to keep the Democratic Party on a straight line towards ethical constitutional democracy instead of these forces of demagoguery and corruption and authoritarianism.
Hmm. You quote current President Joe Biden as saying, democracy needs champions. And I think he is not just speaking about, we need people like Frederick Douglass. We don't need just towering figures who are champions, but each and every one of us can be champions in our own way. And from the Prime Minister of Ireland, Michael Martin, we all must play our part in the untiring effort to protect the integrity of our democratic systems for the future. We've just scratched the surface of your remarkable book, How to Save Democracy, Advice and Inspiration from 95 World Leaders. More than 400 quotations in all gathered together into this book, published by Amplify, and responsible for the book, Eli Merritt. Thank you, Eli Merritt, for joining me today on The Morning Show, and more importantly, thank you for putting together this remarkable book.
Thank you for two things, Greg. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you and your audience. But I also want to thank you for your close reading of the book. I've been speaking about the book quite a bit. No one has taken to the book with such diligence and interest as you have. So I appreciate that close reading.
It was my pleasure. Thank you again.
Okay.
Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview from the morning show archives with Richard Thieme, who's done some of the most intriguing writing in recent years.